Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Atayama, a food writer, the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Tomo Matsushita, who is the spirit sommelier at the Copper and Oak in Lower East Side, New York. Spirits are very popular in the U.S., and if you look at the alcohol beverage market in 2021, beer was the most popular, which accounted for 43% of the market. And the spirits are almost as popular as beer, and their market share was 41%, and the remaining was mostly wine. And spirits are delicious, but if you don't know much about them, it is hard to choose what to drink. And Tomo is the expert who can help you not only to choose what spirit and what brand to drink, but also to understand the story behind each label. And at Copper and Oak, he serves 1,400 labels of spirits. And Tomo's passion and knowledge of spirits are well recognized in the spirits industry, and he received the title of the Icon of Whiskey America in 2021. And as you may know, Japanese whiskey has been one of the hottest categories of spirits in recent years, and Copper and Oak carries 130 Japanese whiskey labels, which is probably the largest number in the whole country. So today we'll discuss Tomo's unique background outside being a spirit sommelier, why Japanese whiskey is different from other types of whiskeys like Scotch and bourbon, which Japanese whiskey brands you should try, how to taste Japanese whiskey, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Tomo Matsushita. Hello, Tomo. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Akiko-san.
So, to get to know you, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
I'm from Osaka, Japan. I moved in United States, actually straight to New York when I was 20. And I'm here for almost 16 years right now.
Hi.
Since I'm from Osaka, the Osaka food culture is a little unique compared to other city in Japan, I guess. Because we are known for konamon, which is like a flour and then sauce. And the sauce is almost like a barbecue sauce in here. So it's like a street food that's I have been eating when I was kids.
Interesting, right? So, I mean, people think of Japanese cuisine like Kyoto Kaiseki, but right next to it, it's Osaka, and the food culture is completely different. Like you said, it's a street food heaven. So, that's right. Yeah, like that in, you know, the home of okonomiyaki, for example. So, konamon is a good term to know. It's like carbs and everything delicious. So, anyway, so you have a very unique background apart from being a spirit expert. So could you tell us how you got into the world of spirits?
So I always kind of curious, when I was a kid, I was curious about the spirits. But first, I just simply, I was thinking when I was a kid, like, I want to be a bartender at some point. So I was brought back. It's not even trained. Like, when I start training, I already moved into the United States. So, but I was working in one of the hotel lounge in Japan, in Osaka. And after that, I came here. I went to school. After I graduate, I start work with the one of the sushi chef who just graduated from Amasa. And then over there, like, we do some cocktail program, something more close to what I hate to call it, the kind of mixology stuff. So I skip all that Japanese authentic, like, a foundation, really foundation of Japanese bartending. I just go straight into the mixology part. Mm. And then after that, I want to learn something more, like, really, I need a good foundation of making cocktails. So I knocked the door at the B-flat, who opened the Angel Share, the one of the very old school Japanese authentic bar. And then my friend who actually worked as a beverage manager at the Copper and Oak and the Brand Library. And then one day he asked me to work. And then here I am, and I'm still stick with them.
Right. Yeah, so it sounds like you had a very good training. And if you're trained in Japanese hotel, that means that you really have the classic training. So that was a good start. Yeah, and then, of course, Angel Share. That's really like the, unfortunately, it's gone now, but it's like the shrine of Japanese cocktail in New York. So,
but I didn't work at the Angel Share. The first, he actually created the space, and then he opened his own bar.
Oh.
It's called B-flat.
Ah,
and
okay.
I was at the B-flat for like 2-3 years.
Mm, right. So that's the family of the Angel Share. And the B-flat, I remember in Tribeca, that has been really, had a great reputation too. So, great. And you didn't mention, but do you have a master's degree in forensic psychology? And so how does it help you with your job as a spirit sommelier?
I mean, I always say like I have the psychology degree in, you know, when I was in school. And then I think somehow like when I sell something, like when I pour something, I always think about how people think in their mind. But then forensic part, I'm not super sure. I'm not looking for a criminal.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. I hope not too.
Right. Okay. Well, you control people's how much they drink, so you're good. Right. I know that, and as I mentioned in introduction, I understand you are very passionate about telling stories behind each label. So it sounds like your master's degree of psychology deeply relates to the story part of your service, right?
Especially when I talk into people, when I pour something, I know that people always have a bias. So sometimes I even hide in the label, and then I just told them like a try, and if you like it, you can take it. And then if you don't like it, I can pick something else. But some bottle, let's say like a Canadian whiskey in the United States, it's somehow like a people looking down. But then Canadian whiskey is amazing. So when I want to sell, let's say Alberta or some like a Canadian club or some Canadian whiskey, that I always want to hide in the label. Because I know as soon as the people see the bottle, they, even though before tasting, like they already thinking like it's, they don't like it. Even though whiskey is amazing.
Mm.
And I would say 90% like people pick by the label or name. So those kind of stuff I do all the time. I pray all the time. And then that I'm sure it's coming from a psychology part.
Mm. Interesting. Right. It's we always have bias about, even like, you know, speaking about Japanese whiskey, pretty much until fairly recently, they are ignored and, and nobody wants to buy Japanese whiskey. That's now what's happening. So, yeah, you are kind of interpreting the meaning behind the labels too. So, okay, so let's talk about spirits. So one of the most popular categories of spirits at the Copper and Oak right now?
We sell little by little. I mean, there are a lot of people really interested in the Japanese whiskey, but as a category, we have a Copper and Oak, we have 130 bottles of Japanese whiskey, which is like one of the biggest collection in New York. And then, but I would say like for category, we sell more whiskey, but we sell some like the other world whiskey too. So, but I know rum is kind of still very kind of hard to sell because people don't really drink in the rum.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Like your world's very important because, how do you drink rum? Like, I don't know exactly. And I'm sure there are great ways to drink it. And just because it's not, well, no, it's like a Japanese sake or shochu. You need education to learn. So,
yeah.
So, right.
But then, like, rum is like a primary, like, really fast, the distilled spirits. And then when the rum came to the United States, like, people start making rye and then moving to bourbon. So, but I don't know. My boss has been doing the business, though, having the bar for like about 20 years. And then he also said, like, in United States, rum is the kind of still kind of hard to sell category. Mm-hmm. But in Europe, people drink in rum all the time. So,
right. Yeah. Well, I really wanted to remember that your boss, who is also the owner of the institutional famous Brandy Library in Tribeca, right? So that's an amazing place. And I think if you're a spirits lover, you really need to know the name, the Brandy Library. So yeah, it sounds like you really have the good collection based on the knowledge and experience of the owner of the Brandy Library. So, okay. So it's like you mentioned, you have one of the biggest selections of Japanese whiskey in the U.S., and you carry around 103 labels, which is huge. So, and Japanese whiskey has been popular for a while like now, and then in the U.S., and even here, popular labels are allocated to each distributor because it's not much made. It's too popular that the producers are not ready to sell so much. So when did Japanese whiskey become so popular, and why?
As I understand, there's the Whiskey Bible and then written by the Jim Murray. And 2015, he picked the Yamazaki Sherry Cask, the 2013 as the best whiskey in the world. And then since then, like, people discovered Japanese whiskey. And then along with that, the Hibiki or any other Japanese whiskey started getting awarded. So then for me, that's the end of the world. The price went up too high right now, but before it was too cheap, I would say.
Right. Yeah, and I heard that you know, the Yamazaki, that's really one of the classic whiskeys by Suntory, and it was aged in sherry cask. And what was amazing I heard is that the Jim Murray, the author of The Guide, he had never awarded that coveted title, you know, the whiskey of the year, not to anything but a Scotch from Scotland in the 12-year history of his whiskey Bible. So that was like, wow, suddenly Japanese, and there's nobody else other than Scotch whiskey. So that really was a big deal. And that's why everybody realized, oh, this Japanese whiskey is something different. So that's interesting, a great thing for Japanese whiskey. And I found a statistic. So the total Japanese whiskey exports have risen by 1,478% between 2010 to 2020. So that's according to the Japanese government. So you can tell how suddenly Japanese whiskey became popular. We'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into different types of Japanese whiskey and what is so special about Japanese whiskey. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Toki Katayama. My guest today is Tomo Matsushita, who is the spirit sommelier at the Copper and Oak in Lower East Side, New York. So there are many different styles of whiskey in the world, and there's a distinctive charm about Japanese whiskey. So first of all, what is the history of Japanese whiskey?
So I would say that as a Japanese whiskey, the making is really starting from the first Japanese whiskey distillery in Japan, Yamazaki. There's Masataka Taketsuru, who went to Scotland, and after he learned how to make a whiskey, and then when he came back, he helped the family of Suntory to create the first distillery in Japan. And that was like a night. Next year, actually, the 100 years anniversary. So they opened 1923. And that's how I would say Japanese whiskey started.
Right. Yeah. So this gentleman who technically learned everything in Scotland about whiskey making, that's Masataka Taketsuru you just mentioned. He's the one technical person. And the Shinjiro Torii, he's the founder of Suntory, which makes Yamazaki and Hibiki, and it's Suntory time, in the movie. So he was a really such a forward-minded person. And this Masataka Taketsuru, I heard he's a son of a sake brewer family, and he worked for some other sake brewery, and that sake brewery wanted to start popular spirits, and then he was sent to Scotland. But then something happened. That brewery who sent him to Scotland just scrapped the plan to make a brewery. So this Masataka Taketsuru was teaching at the middle school, and then he was not doing anything related to whiskey making. But then Shinjiro Torii, the founder of Suntory, hired him, and that was really the foundation of Japanese whiskey. So it's kind of like only two people, but they made the whole foundation of Japanese whiskey. And I think the first whiskey was made in 1929. So it's almost like fairly recently compared to the history of Scotland. So yeah, it's amazing how much Japanese people made progress within 100 years or so.
The first, there are so many legal distilleries back in the day, but the whiskey you can find in the whole world is Bushmill, which is 608, so 1608. So it's still like a whiskey making in the world. It's been like only 500-ish, I would say.
Mm.
But then, yeah, Scotch whiskey, I would say like most of the story, it's about like 200-300 years. So we are still kind of new, as a Japanese whiskey, but still we have a really long history.
Right. Yeah, and then like everything else, Japanese people decided to try to pursue something obsessively and create something in its own category. So Japanese whiskey is one of those products, I think. So What is the difference between Japanese whiskey and other types of whiskey such as scotch and bourbon in terms of the production methods and the style of taste?
So as I understand, that basically like Japanese whiskey or Scottish style. So it's totally wrong. People say Japanese scotch whiskey. But then I would say the way like a Japanese whiskey started, it's most likely Scottish style. So I would say Japanese whiskey is somehow Scottish style, but then American whiskey is then totally different. The distillation process is, the shape is different, but somehow similar. But then they have to use like a very specific cask to make American whiskey, the bourbon rye wheat. The Scotch whiskey, they use like always a reused cask, which is the ex-bourbon or ex-sherry or some wine cask. And then Japanese whiskey also same way that we barely use the cask like the American whiskey. We always using the ex-bourbon cask or sherry cask. But then what actually makes Yamazaki or the Hakushu actually that makes so unique, even in right now actually in the Japanese whiskey category too, but they have like a multiple different shape of a still, and then they basically can make like so many different type of spirits in one distillery, but it's basically single malt. According to like a Scottish Whiskey Association, that you can actually blend in a single distillery, which people misunderstand all the time, but to be called single malt is 100% malted barley coming from a single distillery. So you can blend what we call batting, the V-A-T-T-I-N-G, but basically blend to make the single malt. And so let's say Yamazaki and Hakushu distillery, they can distill multiple different style of spirits. And then in order to make Yamazaki 12, they all mature in a different cask from a different still, and eventually they blended. That really including like, you know, the involving like the art of a blend, but to make a Yamazaki single malt. But then Nikka is founded by the Masataka Taketsuru, who is we call the father of Japanese whiskey. He wanted to make the Scotch style, really Scotch whiskey in Japan. So if you visit his distillery, the Yoichi and the Miyagikyo, you actually more really think that's actual Scotch whiskey distillery like. Because he only used the same shape of a still to create the same whiskey. And then they still, the blending part is like probably the key to make a Japanese whiskey in the case.
Right. Yeah, so it's based on Scotch, but there is a distinctive difference. And one thing I noticed is that, because Suntory started the whole whiskey production, it's been dominant for a while. And so they make everything from scratch. So you need different kinds of whiskey to blend, which, like you said, blending is really a key component of Japanese whiskey. So they control vertically 100%. So they make ingredient whiskeys, and up until bottling, they control everything. So it's like a meticulously controlled flavor. And Scotland, you can buy whiskey ingredients, like base whiskeys, from other distilleries, but in the case of Japanese whiskey, the majority has been just made everything controlled by one company. And so that's why the blending becomes perfect. And, the chief brand of Fukuyo of Suntory, who joined us a while ago on this program, so he said usually he can blend and to make his, Yamazaki or his Hibiki whiskeys, he mixes 6 to 20 different base whiskeys, which is very, very different from, say, like bourbon is out of 3. So Yeah, so blending, the art of blending is also the Japanese whiskey's major characteristic, I heard. Yeah, so it's similar to Scotland, but Japanese whiskey is very different. Yeah, so, and also, what do you think about the peat flavor? Peat is used in Scotland heavily to dry, you know, make the malt. And it's kind of smoky. It's sometimes overly smoky to some people. Do you see less peat in Japanese whiskeys?
So I would say until very recent, like 90s, 70s, or like 60s, that still the, you know, the, as a Japanese, we know sake, which is a fermented rice, like we call rice whiskey in here sometimes. Also, like we drink a lot of beers, and then, but also in, for Japanese palate, we always eat and then drink. So we don't, we are not really super familiar with something very strong flavor, strong alcohol, strong spirits. So we are not really, especially back in the day when Yamazaki Distillery founded, or Yoichi Distillery founded, I guess like nobody, I assume nobody like whiskey because it's too strong. So we always mix with soda or water.
Yes. So yeah, it's interesting, right? Because the Japanese alcohol culture tend to drink and eat and drink, they're pairing the sake and shochu, same thing. So that makes sense that people don't want to have huge peat flavor of just very smoky. And also, I mean, American bourbon itself, it's, you know, the new oak flavor and toasted new oak, which is like vanilla and caramel and delicious, but probably won't go well with Japanese food. So yeah, that's another element. People tend to have mild whiskey, which is a Japanese style whiskey, because you can pair it with food. Although, the highball, whiskey highball, mixed with soda water, that's like versatile. You can drink by itself and also pair it with good food, Japanese or non-Japanese food. So,
yeah, so I would say when you're making highball, it would be actually better with a little bit of peat. So, but as I tried, I tried to explain that yeah, our food culture or drinking culture is always with the food. So the peat is like a very strong, very dominant palate. And then plus like you can actually find the peat in Japan, but basically it's a natural resource. So the Japanese government doesn't want to even allow us to use the peat.
Mm.
On the other hand, like Scotland, let's say if you go there, you barely even see forests or trees. So there's nothing they can burn except the peat. And peat is like organic matter coming from the ground. So they dig like 7-8 feet deep to take around like 2 feet of peat. And they dry and they make a tea. Because need to make a fire by the peat. Or they're cooking by the peat. It's like back in the day, like before all the oils, all the gas coming to the Scotland. Then that's the only resource, the actual natural resource they have. And hey, then that has a really distinct flavor. And then I personally love it, but I'm sure back in the day, like Japanese people are not really familiar. So, but then that's why I assume like around like 1973, the Hakushu was built up. It's by the Suntory. And then I assume like around the time like Suntory finally start thinking Japanese people drinking more whiskey and then they are more accept the flavor of peat. So Hakushu is like, it's not super heavy. They make a heavy peat too, but they're always like 12 years, 18 years. The 25 years, it's very faint, gentle peat. But I think that's around the time really Japanese people really accepting like a flavor of peat.
Interesting. Oh, wow. That's like a very out of necessity and terroir-driven Scottish peat. So I have to remember that. Okay. And then, yeah, we said how quickly Japanese whiskey has become popular since 2015. So since then, we have seen a flux of new labels called air quote Japanese whiskey in the Japanese domestic market as well as the global market, which is exported from Japan. But some people don't like them to be called Japanese whiskey. So what is the issue here?
So the issue is in Japan, we actually don't really have a Japanese whiskey like as a category. There's a Japanese whiskey, but it's not like really regulated by the law, the government. Let's say when you talk about Scotch whiskey, there's very strict law to make a Scotch whiskey. And basically, you have to everything make in Scotland. And also, they also mentioned how long they need to stay, keep in old cask for maturation. But, and also, let's say if you talk about, when you talk about the American whiskey, you can go to the TTB to see all the regulation to make a bourbon, rye, American whiskey, or blended whiskey. But then if you check the Japanese like a government page, they don't really mention about how to make a Japanese whiskey. So basically, really, you can actually make anything to make a Japanese whiskey. Even though, let's say I get Scotch whiskey, I pour into the, looks like I prepare Japanese in bottles, and I don't even need to blend. I can sell as a Japanese whiskey. And it's extremely to say, but it is, yeah, it's cheating, but nobody against me to, you know, stop doing it. So I can just sell as a Japanese whiskey. But then if somebody asks me if it's Japanese whiskey, I would say no, because I would say maybe as a Japanese, I am Japanese, so I would say I bottle for you, but inside is 100% Scotch whiskey.
Right. So nobody likes those free riders just because Japanese whiskey name sells, and inside it's not. It's a low quality non-Japanese spirits called whatever it is. You can just purchase at very cheap price because there's no quality control. So yeah, I really think it's a bad dilution of the quality driven Japanese whiskey. So that's something like I understand why some people get upset, and I hope something is going to happen to control, you know, what's actually being controlled. So and just to complicate the situation a little further, there is a category of whiskey that is made of shochu, which is Japanese traditional spirits made with, koji malt. So there's an issue of some people don't like what's called whiskey made with shochu. So what is the issue here?
So it is actually the issue too, but I would say I understand that the shochu has like an even longer history in Japan, like a 400-500 year history, and the whiskey is like a very new, it's still 100 years. But shochu is like a distilled spirit made also from grain, and like it can be like a sweet potato, barley, like a whiskey, and also can be rice or like the buckwheat, like a soba. And shochu is a shochu. So, and then shochu producer has been making shochu for 100 years. And then all of a sudden, like some people start making the whiskey out of shochu. So they have a problem making shochu. And then why you start selling whiskey all of a sudden because of Japanese whiskey can sell as a brand name, they can sell a lot. So that would be probably the issue. But as a spirit, I would say it would be nice to have a little more category or variety of the Japanese whiskey. Because in the end, like, let's say if people drink as a Japanese whiskey, it's made out of shochu, and then some people like it, and then maybe they can actually move to shochu, and then maybe shochu as a category can be also famous in the rest of the world. Because shochu is basically very only consumed in Japan. It's not like worldwide. So personally, this is like actually a great opportunity for shochu to be spread around. But I also understand that shochu is shochu, and then I love shochu too. So it's, every time I drink the whiskey made out of shochu, I think, you know, this is shochu, it's not whiskey.
Right. It's interesting, right? So, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that shochu is going to be following the path of sake, which is now becoming popular, although it's not, you know, widely drunk throughout the country yet. But, yeah, it's a great quality, high quality, traditional, valuable beverage. And as we discussed earlier, in Japan, people add some water or hot water or something, really balanced way to drink shochu with food, which is great because you can control the alcohol level and it's really clean, very local, ingredients very representative of the region that's produced. And yeah, just like, you know, we both very strongly about the value of the preciousness of shochu. But then this whiskey thing, so there are two camps of this shochu made into whiskey. So one is just like air quote Japanese whiskey within the bottle, who knows where, it's like cheap scotch or something, like really low quality item. And then in Japan, the shochu makers can distill new spirits because their facility already has, you know, distilling equipment. So that's, there's no quality guarantee. But the other camp of the Japanese shochu-based whiskey, I got to know one of them was the Fukano whiskey, which is a traditional shochu producer in Kumamoto. And then they started aging their premium shochu in oak barrel in the 80s. And that was great. And they were hoping to just sell as shochu in the market in Japan. But when Margaret Thatcher pressured the Japanese government, you can't sell colored shochu because it's going to compete with scotch. So the Japanese government banned to sell the whiskey colored shochu in the market. So the Fukano whiskey is one of the examples that forever sleeping in the barrel shochu, because there's no way to be sold in the market in Japan, was discovered by an American spirit distributor. And now it's sold as kind of whiskey, and I tasted it. It's amazing. So I think even shochu-based whiskey can be two ways. It can be really good quality or just really, like, what is this? It shouldn't be called Japanese whiskey because the quality is so bad. So the market right now is very confusing because Japanese whiskey became popular just because of the quality recognized by the Whiskey Bible. But currently, it's a chaos. So hopefully...
Yeah, I think that's also the issue for the within the Japanese whiskey, because as I mentioned, there's no actual category or like regulation. So like a Suntory Yoichi has been making whiskey almost 100 years. And all of a sudden, shochu producers start making whiskey, whiskey shochu or shochu whiskey. So then is this same spirits? I want to say it's different. So... Mm-hmm. Let's say like even Copper and Oak, I don't put on the same shelf that the actual Scottish whiskey style Japanese whiskey. Like Yamazaki, Hakushu, Yoichi, or even new producer, like let's say Akeshi, it's like a heavy repeat, but it's from Hokkaido, but they're really making the Scottish way to make a whiskey. So I put all the whiskey from an old school way to make a Scottish style whiskey on the one side. But the other side, like I put the all rice base or shochu base whiskey because I want to make it separate clearly because this is old school Japanese whiskey. And if you want to try something, we often say like a new terroir or a new territory, like a new Japanese whiskey, you can try like a shochu base whiskey. So I still want to always, when I work at the Copper and Oak, I always say, this is not traditional, and this is traditional. And then I suggest like you should starting from a base. And then as a spirit, again, like I like a shochu based whiskey too, but I can say that's a traditional whiskey because that's clearly shochu. It's a little higher proof to try to get into the whiskey category. But some shochu-based whiskey cannot sell in Japan as a whiskey because, as you mentioned, the Japanese government clearly want to keep shochu as a category in Japan. So even whiskey or any spirits, it depends on the country. They have a different definition. So it is... Every time I work in there, or I suggest, or I talk about whiskey, I have to distinct the what's shochu base and what's Scottish like way to make a Japanese whiskey.
Right. I really think also taste wise, I find the koji based shochu creates kind of milder mouthfeel, and also it's kind of rounded taste as well, even if the color looks like whiskey. So yeah, it's just maybe we have to come up with a new category instead of like calling shochu as whiskey. We have to find the best way to really not lose the special nature of shochu itself. And just because Japanese whiskey name works for selling shochu-based colored shochu, spirits. It doesn't sound quite right now.
I totally agree.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about Copper and Oak, because I found it very unique and the space is very cozy, personal, and a bit of magical. And the feeling comes from the walls of wonderful spirits and I think ambience you create personally too. So tell us about Copper and Oak. How does it look like? And what is your mission at Copper and Oak?
So Copper and Oak is tiny, very tiny place. Like we have a nearly 1,400 bottle of whiskey, brandy, mezcal, tequila, rum. So it's all spirits for sipping. When we start open at 2014, we still offer a little small cube of ice. But then after 2 years, like we really stick with like a no ice policy. And also we don't make any cocktails. So it's really sipping. But then we offer one shot and half shot, which is a 2 ounce and 1 ounce. So people sometimes come here to just try the 1 ounce before they commit like a whole bottle to buy in a liquor store. So it is very cool concept. Because the brandy library, we also have actually bigger collection, but then we also provide like expensive, like a very luxury lounge bar. So we have ice, we have a cocktail, we have a food without the nice looking like a couch. And then, so it's different style of a bar. But
almost the opposite, right? Brandy library is like luxurious, like spacious. But then Copper and Oak is like, don't tell anybody. This is my space, like secret and very personal.
But then I think a Kappa and Dog is the place like people can discover something new. So it is hard to sell something that the people see everywhere. Like, you know, Johnny Walker we have, and then we have 10 different Johnny Walker. But I would say people see in other place all the time. So Johnny Walker is kind of hard to sell. On the other hand, like some other blended whiskey, like we can sell easy because people want to discover something new. So like the back to the first question, like we have we always offer something new. So whiskey as a category we sell most, but let's say if you drink a peaty whiskey, the Scotch whiskey or Japanese whiskey, that something's peaty, why don't you try the mezcal? The phenol content is quite similar. It's made from agave, but it is different spirits and different flavor. But it's something linked to like a phenol that, that you can find in a mezcal and then peaty whiskey. So maybe you can try mezcal tonight or something. If you like a bourbon, something caramel, honey, like heavy spirits. Then why don't you try that Armagnac, which is a French like grape-based spirits, but then somehow you can find a kind of very similar tasting profile, can maybe link to what you usually drink. So I think in a Kappa and Dog, I also probably like to challenge people sometimes, but I offer something new. So I think that's my probably also one of the mission at Kappa and Dog. And I really enjoy.
Yeah, I really respect that. How can you remember 1,400 labels? And, you know, you can really have to, you have to understand this flavor profile and also the stories behind it. And I think it's like a librarian in a way, like, you know, the classic books. And it sounds like a lot of fun. And also, you know, your space is really, you know, because of the colors of the whiskey and the spirits, it's kind of very interesting space. It's almost like you went to a medieval castle or something, and it's such a very narrow, you know, you're very in front of me when I go there, and I can really talk to you and ask questions about what you're offering. So I really think it's a very special place.
Yeah, that's the concept. The one of the concepts also, like, we play only 80s music because my boss said, like, all the whiskey drinker has to go through the 80s. but also, I basically, when I pour something, I need to tell something about whiskey or any whiskey brandy, mezcal, tequila. I need to give, like, some information. And then, I also need to talk to.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, you are the only person, basically, right, who's managing the space. So if we listeners go there, it's tomorrow, it's going to be you, right, waiting for your guests.
At this moment, like after pandemic, two of our colleagues left the country. So I'm the only one sadly working there. I mean, I enjoy, but and also that's why, like, if I keep selling the same bottle, I get bored. And then I want to find something our guests like. And then especially they like to discover something new. So I need to sell little by little for everywhere, basically.
Right. Okay. And then, so who's your customer?
After pandemic, it's really changing because before pandemic or around pandemic, there's like medical people coming, but then now it's all IT, I would say. But then the Friday or weekend, like we are located in the Lower East Side, so it's actually a lot of young people in here. It's like 20 or 30 years old. And then Thursday or a little slower day or slower time too. The still 30, 40s, 60s. Yeah, I would say it's all over.
Which is interesting because the younger generations, I thought drinking less spirits and more beer or something else. So it's interesting, right? Because it's such a profound world to discover about spirits.
Yeah. It's like, actually the first 1-2 years after we really stopped serving ice, people actually leave every time I say like we don't have ice. And then last 5-6 years, I would say, like people still sipping with the ice. So I really kind of seen that all the, you know, how people drinking that differently the last couple of years.
Okay, so speaking of, at your place or at your home, what's your favorite way to taste Japanese whiskey? I mean, there are many whiskeys, so I have to pick. So take Japanese whiskey. What's your favorite way?
I was actually start with like a highball, like a whiskey soda, and then move to like a really sipping. And then I would say people always say like I can drink whiskey because it's too strong. But then think about how much you drink in a cocktail. Like whiskey actually you drink slow. So it is strong on the palate, but then you don't shoot. So, and then it keep changing the glasses too. So it's fun. But then personally, I drink neat all the time.
I like the way how it looks, like you know, in the glass, and also as the temperature warms up, the smell is more evaporated to your nose. So I agree, neat is kind of, you know, extend the time you are able to taste it, unless you do a shot. So
such a really wasting that you people doing shot, because once you pour in the glass and then you smell, and then the alcohol is very sharp. But as it oxidizes, like let's say 5 minutes, 10 minutes, even like sometimes I wait like 1 hour or a couple hours, not decanting, but some spirits are still too tight. So I see like a whole time, like see that the changing in my glass all the time. So every time I go to the bar, I usually order like a 2-3 pour of whiskey, or can be mezcal, tequila, rum too, but also brandy. But I order 2-3 drink in front of me, and then I sip little by little for like an hour.
Mm.
So maybe to other bartender, I don't spend enough money, but that's how I drink, and then that's how I discover something new, and then it can be applied to my job too, because this glass, this whiskey, you have to wait 20 minutes and then come back to 20 minutes. But meanwhile, maybe I can pour something else too. But just I'm a drinker too, more like, to be honest, I hate to call myself sommelier bartender, but I'm a drinker also. So I'm looking for or seeking something, you know, fun in my glass all the time. So, and I like to share with the people,
right,
if I find.
Yeah, I understand that, especially if you have different flavors, you can taste the contrast, and then you appreciate each more probably. So that's interesting. I want to ask this question. So I heard about the Japanese gins are popular too, right? Do you carry Japanese gins, and are they popular?
We don't have any gin in the vodka, but I have in my house a few bottles of Japanese gin. I drink gin too, but it is fun. Gin is like it's very popular in not only in Japan. It's also like right now all the Scotland, like if you go to the Scotland, people think all the Scottish people drinking Scotch whiskey, which is not true. They drinking gin and beer. So gin culture is really popping up in everywhere in the whole world.
Right. Well, I heard it in Spain, people are not drinking wine, Spanish wine, but instead usually gin and tonic of different flavors. So gin is kind of very overlooked category, but actually people drinking it. So,
but in Japan, we have a lot of our own herbs and spice. So we our gin is also quite unique. Now, my friend making mezcal, and then he's American from New York, but he always seeking some ingredients in the whole world. So now he lives in Oaxaca, and then he actually making gin / absinthe / mezcal. because based on the mezcal, he used some botanical, and then he found out the local juniper. So it is gin, but also he found out the local wormwood to make absinthe. So he put everything to make a gin / absinthe / mezcal. So you can clearly see that the terroir driven, like all the herbs or spice you can find in local, and then you can really make a very unique gin in each local, you know, even prefecture in Japan too.
Right. Well, that's the point, right? We tend to forget that spirits are kind of very regional drinks of whichever the culture comes from. So yeah, that's a great point. So, okay. So I think we need to wrap up here. So what are your plans and dreams?
I guess today is tequila or mezcal. It was now it's 80 degrees outside.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you really, this is ridiculous, right? After New York City marathon days, so.
It's an Indian summer, so it's hot outside today.
Right. Okay, so enjoy those. So can we find your updates online and on social media? Where is the address?
I taking care of the Copper and Look Instagram. Facebook, not that much, because it linked to the Instagram, so it's same post you can find.
Okay, so you can just search Copper and Oak.
Yeah, or people shoot me a message sometime ago, what to buy, what to drink, even though they're not Copper and Oak, and then I respond. So shoot me a message sometime.
Right, and also, of course, if you go to Copper and Oak, Tomo is behind the bar, so... That's really an amazing space. And it's really special space. Hopefully, you know, that place, maybe you open a brunch or something. But yeah. All right. So good luck and keep me posted. And Instagram account is Copper and Oak NYC. That's one word, Copper and Oak NYC.
Yes.
Right. All right. So thank you so much for joining us today, Tomo.
No, thank you very much.
Right, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikuatema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Amin Spenjan, and I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.